This is Sophie, and you're listening to the Jew and the Gentile podcast.
I'm Charles Breton.
And I'm Chris Henson. And together we are
a Jew
and a Gentile
walk into a bar
mitzvah.
Wishing I could change the things that I screwed up. What am I supposed to do? I can't give up. You know I can't give up.
Yeah, well, welcome into episode 73 of A Jew and a Gentile Walk into a Bar Mitzvah, the podcast. I am Charles Breton, the Jew, with as always, with Chris Henson, the Gentile.
I am still Gentile.
Yeah, and gainfully employed Gentile.
Actually. Gainfully employed. I keep feeling like every time I go to work, I feel like Haley Joel Osment in that I, too, see dead people. So,
yeah, you might want to explain that.
Yeah, I work for hospice.
I mean, there you go.
I mean, I'm just glad to talk to two people that I hope that aren't within 6 months of their own death. So,
well,
this is greatly improving over my earlier part of my day.
True. But then I can't make any guarantees for anyone who listens to this podcast.
No, but I figure between the alcohol and the cigars, we got a good shot.
Which reminds us, we've had a suggestion for a new tagline from Megan Smoot at Jawworks. So we want to welcome you to the podcast where you come for the theology, whiskey, cigars, and F-bombs.
Right. Yeah. That sounds like us.
Sounds like us. You're hopefully listening to us on either Apple Podcasts, Theology Corner at theologycorner.net, and we're also available on Stitcher now. So just about any place you get your podcast, you can find us.
Right. You can ignore us in three different venues.
Right. And I love doing that because you're telling people this is how you can listen to us, which they're only going to hear if they've already found us and are listening to us.
Right.
Right.
It's a paradox, really.
It is. It's like my marriage. It's a paradox. So we need to thank our sponsors and acknowledge them. Of course, we always start with Men of the Beard Oil from our good friend, Pastor Nar.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the Luna. Well, I and my new dog and my daughter enjoy the new Luna scent that he gifted me at Wild Goose Festival this year. So I enjoy it.
Well, it's good. And it makes your beard oh so soft and cuddly.
Right. Just like the rest of me. Built for comfort. Whose? I'm not sure.
Yeah, we're still trying to work that out. Definitely not mine. Virgil Cane Whiskey is another one of our excellent sponsors. We love them. They send us whiskey, send us stickers and gifts and wonderful stuff. Their ginger-infused bourbon is fantastic.
And bugger all, you cannot find them but in two locations here in the Triad so far. And those places are selling out quicker than they can get them unboxed.
Yes, and sometimes they don't even bother unboxing them. They just, you know, the shipment comes in, they just walk it out and put it in someone's trunk.
Yeah, the poor guy that I went, when I got the Glenlivet we enjoyed this past weekend, I was looking for Virgil Cane. He just rolled his eyes like, oh, man, if I had a bottle to sell for everybody that came in and asked that.
All right, he could sell a bottle.
Bottles.
Yeah. We also have to mention the Pipe and Pint, the oldest brick-and-mortar tobacconist in Greensboro.
On Spring Garden?
On Spring Garden.
We haven't done that bit in a while. I'm glad I remembered that.
Yeah. They're definitely one of our favorite places to get cigars. They have probably the best humidor in the Southeast, that's for sure. A lot of new stuff in also. They got a lot of new, the Viajes are in from the cigar show. A lot of good stuff happening there. Also need to thank another proud sponsor, Four Saints Brewing Company, a great beer for great people in Asheboro.
And they still let us drink it.
They still let us drink it, even though we're not great people.
Or not.
And in October, we're going to be starting Drinking Religiously on the second Tuesday of the month.
You've been drinking religiously for a while now.
For a long time. Well, that's, you know, Virgil Cane.
Right.
But we're actually going to talk religion while we're drinking, which is going to be very interesting. Because the other thing about us is the more you drink, the better we sound. And also want to mention Top Leaf Cigar Lounge.
Our home away from
our
home.
Our home away from home. This premier cigar lounge in the Triad in Winston-Salem. And the place where we met our guest tonight. And where we're going to introduce him because he is also a cigar smoker.
There's news a reason to like him.
At least one. At least
at one. Least.
At least. So joining us tonight is Byron Williams. He's one of the leading public theologians in the nation. He's a columnist, author, and the former pastor of Resurrection Community Church in Berkeley, California. He's now president and CEO of the Kairos Movement, a progressive theological think tank in Winston-Salem. He's also the host of the syndicated NPR-affiliated and hopefully soon PRI.
Yes.
Broadcast, The Public Morality. So, Byron, welcome. And we always like talking cigars at the beginning. So you wanted to tell us your favorite cigar.
Oh, my favorite cigar, without question, Liga Privada T52 Double Corona.
Ooh. Wow. Okay.
All right.
It's a good cigar.
I mean, that's just my absolute favorite because it's everything that I want in a cigar. It tastes good. It's consistent all the way through from start to finish. It burns immaculate. I've never had a cigar that burns better and evenly than the T52. It's just like the whatever your favorite car is. If your favorite car is a Rolls Royce, it's the Rolls Royce of cigars for me. If your favorite car is a Porsche, it's the Porsche of cigars. It depends on what your favorite car is. That's what that cigar is for me.
And it's a good price point, too.
Yeah, not going to get much of an argument.
No, in fact, there are cigars just on, and I want to specify this, on rare occasions, I have spent more money for and came away extremely disappointed because I've compared it to the T52 and I've been left wanting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's what people say about our podcast all the time. That on rare occasions, they compare us to other podcasts and come away wanting. But that's why we've added you. So hopefully that won't happen. Chris, what are you not smoking? You're in your new home and you can't smoke inside. And it's too hot to be outside.
I've had three good cigars over the last few days.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the Ego Gold.
I had the Ego Gold last night.
That was that? Because somebody really nice got you that.
Right. And somebody's also been encouraging me to smoke Connecticut Shade and more Candela-type wrapped cigars. And I was thoroughly...
You got to branch out.
I was thoroughly impressed. Light-bodied. But then again, like Byron's mentioning his favorite cigar, I'm still LFD Cabinet 5. So doesn't quite measure up with that kind of pepper and spice.
That's probably number two for me.
It's a win-win either way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But just enjoyed that. Had coffee notes, definite earthy. It was really good. And I've also tried finally the Jeffrey Amendola out of Bull City Cigars, Connecticut. That one blew me away. That may make me a convert to not turning my nose up at medium bodied Connecticut Shade cigars. But if we're going to talk about the last cigar we smoked together, my former work wife.
You're really going there, aren't you?
Former work wife went to Canada for a wedding, but because she's a good woman, she brought back three Cohibas, the Tubos Robustos, I think. Mm-hmm. And me, you, and Helena enjoyed that, and finally we drank my scotch, and it was a good night. It was about time.
Yeah, that was a good night. I hadn't had an actual real Cuban Cohiba in a while, and that was nice.
But it does ruin you for everything else. But you know,
kind of. I don't know if you like that kind of thing.
You know, Byron was talking about that cigar where like you paid more money and you're like just disappointed. My experience, that's been my experience with like Davidoff cigars. It's got the large price point. Mm-hmm. It's got all the advertising. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of really I tried the Darkest Hour, the one they released with sort of the Churchill logo on it.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, I was so excited to smoke that. This is going back last winter. And it was just like, this is it. That was my Super Bowl cigar.
Well, wouldn't you rather have the Cabot number 5 in the darkest hour, especially when you factor in the price point?
I could have had 2 Cabinet 5s for what I paid for that campaign.
Oh, absolutely.
And I got both the cigars, not the Cuban one, but the other two we got from Top Leaf there in Winston.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm actually smoking because I have an indoor smoking lounge.
Your empty nest.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Well, for the moment, not so much, but it will be again soon. So I'm smoking the Sons of Anarchy by Black Crown. And this is the cigar that they created. Yes, it is created to be part of the television show Sons of Anarchy.
There could be worse cigars to have.
Certainly, because there are worse TV shows. But I liked the Sons of Anarchy. I thought it was a good show.
Hadn't watched it yet.
Well done. Oh, you got to watch it. It's pretty good.
Right.
The last couple seasons, I was like, not so much. But it started out really, really well. The cigar starts out well and stays well. It's Ecuadorian Oscura wrapper, Nicaraguan long fill and binder. So, you know, the wood, the leather, the sweetness, the spice that you would expect from that combination of Oscura and Nicaraguan. Very well constructed. A smooth draw, a lot of smoke. Very much enjoying this cigar.
So how biker is it? I mean, are you now referring to Mrs. Dr. Future Rabbi Jew as your old lady?
Not in her presence, no.
Right.
I know better than that. After 30 years. See, that's something you would do because you and Summer have been married for 30 years.
That'd get you, that'd kill you quicker than cigars and alcohol will.
Absolutely.
So, and seriously limit your enjoyment of Shabbos every week. So
that's right. It's a double mitzvah on Shabbos. It's only one of the reasons why I love being a Jew.
Only one.
It's one of many. It definitely has its tribulations. It's not easy, but it has its upside.
And now for something completely different.
Four Saints Brewing Company. Four Saints pays homage to the patron saints of beer, Saint Wenceslas, Saint Nicholas, Saint Luke, and Saint Augustine of Hippo. They've become the most recognized patron saints for brewing and beer because of their contributions to and associations with the world's favorite sudsy beverage. Four Saints founders Joel McCloskey and Andrew Deming are carrying on the brewing tradition in hopes of future sainthood, or at least to make some really good beer. Four Saints Brewing Company, Asheboro, North Carolina.
Well, speaking of faith and religion.
Ba-dum-poom-ching.
Yeah.
I can insert that sound. I got that. Okay.
Okay. Go put the rim shot in there.
I'll put the rim shot in.
We're known for our smooth segues. You know, we just from one topic to another, and it's just seamless. So from cigars to a lot of interesting things. So one of the reasons that we asked Byron on the show, just other than the fact that we like Byron, we like talking with him. We've had some great conversations in the lounge at
Proving again that cigar lounges are great places to meet good folks.
They are. In fact, I had this. I have to go on an aside here before we actually get into our topic. I teach at a local community college. I teach writing in English. And when you teach English, you can't help but talk about the language. And therefore, I find it important to comment to my students and point out to them that
semantics.
A lot of the things that we do in English were choices that were made starting in the 11th century. And most of those choices were made by rich, landed, powerful white men.
Thank goodness that's changed.
Yeah. But it is why that change is so difficult, because the language has the racism and the sexism cooked into it.
Don't forget the anti-Semitism.
Well, that too.
Right.
But particularly sexism and racism is cooked into the language. And so we've talked about overcoming that and how you can still use language, because you have to in order to talk about these things. So the other day, a student commented, she's quite taken by the fact that my being, as she said, an old white guy, I talked about a lot of very interesting and liberal ideas in class, and so she wondered how I managed to survive when I'm around other old white guys.
And to confirm, you are in fact an old white guy.
Well, I'm an old guy, and for people for whom race is significant, I'm not white, but I understand that my skin is much paler than a lot of other people's, and so I'm often identified by others as white.
I'm distracting you, so go back. The student was saying.
The student was saying, you know, that I seem to be a pretty, you know, hip old white guy, and how do I manage being around other old white guys and not go crazy? Because obviously, all old white guys are conservative and prejudiced and sexist and racist. And I said, well, I smoke cigars and drink lots of whiskey.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'll do it every time.
Yeah. You know, you find that equalizer. You find that place where we start from, oh, did you like that cigar? Have you tried this cigar? And relationships change and attitudes change. And it's very rare that you're going to get into a lot of trouble talking about these things in a cigar lounge. Anyway, so yeah, we met Byron at Top Leaf, and we've just enjoyed some wonderful, awesome conversations. And I had this idea for this topic that we're going to talk about, and Byron was the first one who came to mind for us to have on the show to talk about it. And it's this: we are at a point in our country's history where you hear a lot in terms of resistance and resisting and opposing the oppressive nature of what is going on, the resurgence in white nationalism, in racism and sexism in our country. And a lot of the people leading that resistance movement tend to be progressive white American Christians. And I recall that in reading Reinhold Niebuhr's critique of Christian ethics, he pointed out that...
You lasted 18 minutes. I'm actually proud of your restraint.
Well, because I had to wait till actually... It's got to be appropriate. I just don't bring these people up just to bring them up, Boober. There's got to be a reason. Anyway, so as I was saying, so Niebuhr wrote that big problem with Western Christianity is that it's no longer the religion of the oppressed, but the religion of the oppressor. And that's very true in American white Christianity. It has always been the religion of the oppressor. But African-American Christianity is still very much the religion of the oppressed. So I started wondering that, is there some things, some lessons about resistance that white progressive Christians can learn from African-American Christians? And not only could they learn those lessons and implement them, but could they do it without falling into the trap of cultural appropriation, which is always a danger? And so we thought of Byron, because these are things that we've sort of talked about with him. Also, for those of you who are listening and obviously not looking at us,
which is why you're still listening.
Great. If you haven't met Chris and I, we are two. Well, you're a middle-aged white guy. I'm an old white guy. Thanks. And if we were to talk about this, then that would absolutely be racist. So we've invited Byron Williams, who is African-American, so now we're a little less racist, although I think saying, oh, well, let's get a black guy on to talk about black things is about as racist.
You say that sound like some of my best friends are African-American.
Right. Some of our guests are African-American. But the idea is that this is not something that we can talk about ourselves. As much privilege as we have, I'm not taking that privilege. So
we probably should stop talking then.
Well, I just have to
throw to Byron.
Yeah.
Set it up nicely.
Well, before I throw to Byron, another disclaimer that he pointed out when we were talking about setting up this podcast is, we are understanding that when we say things like white Christianity or white church and African-American Christianity or black church, that these things are not monolithic and that there is a lot of diversity in attitudes with these things. But generally speaking, African-American church in America has a much longer and, more importantly, more recent history of standing up against oppression and resisting. And white American Christianity has none of that. So
that's a very monolithic statement about all white Christianity.
Yes, it is.
But yes, anyway.
Even in its diversity.
Okay. Yes. So
Byron, I know that when I mentioned this to you, we've kind of put you off for a week because you got all excited about this. So what is your take, my friend?
Well, you know, I thought several things, even just in your introduction, several things came to mind. And one of them is the notion of the black church. And I thought about going today, if I went to a jazz concert, if I went to a blues concert, those are, painting broad strokes, those are creations those African-American creations.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to a blues concert or a jazz concert, I'm talking about straight ahead jazz. I'm not talking about Kenny G or anything like that, but straight ahead jazz.
Talk about the real thing.
The real thing. And a blues concert, that is the dominant group there will more than likely be white. So that's the group that's keeping it alive. So I see the black church in a similar vein to this regard. When you look at from the founding of this country up until 1865, the black church was as close as it's ever been as being about liberation. It was because that was up until 1865 to the end of slavery. The church's primary mission was about freedom and liberation. That's where the Christianity that was forced upon them, because they had to work, they had to be Christian. They couldn't be anything else because it was against the law. But then they would then appropriate that Christianity in private worship services late at night and saw God as being on the side of the oppressed. So you're absolutely right about that. So that in itself is a countercultural expression in America, that God's side of the oppressed. But after 1865, when you have at least emancipation on paper, the black church took two roads. One road was still a liberation road. Another road was one of survival. Like, we have this high number of people, 90% at one time, 95% were illiterate, you know, needed jobs. So the church took on a lot of the church took on a larger role. And then even with the civil rights movement and Jim Crow, you still see that tension, because as African-American church expands and to some degree is successful, it then becomes this place that is closer to the empire, which means it becomes closer to the religion, you know, of the oppressor. I'm not saying it's there, but it becomes closer. So by the time we reach the 21st century, the only thing, by and large, that the African American church is progressive on is race. It was closer to the empire on gender, much closer to the empire in terms of LGBTQ rights.
Right.
And so that sort of hierarchy. So, Chris, you want to jump in here?
No, I'm agreeing. I was giving you a
So when you look at, for example, the civil rights movement, one of the books I wrote, 1963, The Year of Hope and Hostility, and I interviewed James Lawson, who was the architect of nonviolent civil disobedience for that movement. He shared with me that in Birmingham in 1963, there were 500 black churches in Birmingham and the surrounding area. Less than 20 of those churches actively participated with Martin Luther King in that movement. And because of television, we look at the black church as en masse. So I say all that large, long preamble, if you will, to say that what we're really talking about is a really small slice of the black church that can still be and still have some lessons to teach that largest group, but it is a very small slice, because one of the things about that slice is that it came out when it was sort of the black church was just part of the black culture. And what I mean by that is that, you know, the music in the black church reflected a lot of what was going on with black people. Jazz at one time reflected a lot of what was going on with black people. Blues reflected what was going on with black people. After the 63 bombing, church bombing, Sam Cooke is singing "A Change Is Gonna Come." You know, Curtis Mayfield singing "People Get Ready." So you had all of that was part of the ethos. That it was all in one. And I don't know if you have that in the same way now. I don't know. You know, what's that song? These bitches ain't loyal. I don't know if that's the same. I don't know if that's the same eating. I don't know.
Right, but there may not be currently the leaders or artists that can provide these lessons and examples, but there are the historical ones though.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, right. And I think that some of those lessons, I mean, you know, just take one probably with what I'm most familiar with being the civil rights movement. When you study that movement, it was they probably made as many mistakes. It was a myriad of mistakes that led to an ultimate victory. It's probably the best way to say it. It was a failed campaign in 1962 in Albany, Georgia.
Right.
And it was largely a failed campaign in Birmingham because Bull Connor was taking the playbook from Lori Pritchard in Albany, Georgia, and using that playbook, so there wasn't much notoriety. What the good fortune for that movement was that there was also an election that year. And because Bull Connor was the commissioner of public safety, Birmingham had changed its charter. So the commissioner of public safety would then serve at the pleasure of the mayor. So Bull Connor had to run for mayor. He was out of a job. So they had the good fortune. So Bull Connor then has to show the people his value. Police dogs, fire hoses is the result. Television catches it. That's really the first time television really caught it and put it on display in a meaningful way. So they had some good fortune. So within that, though, there was a common purpose. You got to have some luck, but there was common purpose. There were lots of reasons. There were a number of people who wanted to shy away from nonviolent civil disobedience and wanted to grab a gun.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they were steadfast in not allowing that to happen. And so when you mentioned today's efforts, one of the things I would say is I would not advocate that this movement needs to have a central leader or figurehead, because the civil rights movement didn't have a central leader or figurehead. The press dubbed Martin Luther King that person, but there were a plethora of people at the grassroots movement that made those things happen.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I wouldn't offer that, but I would offer that one of the things this movement could embrace is a central message that cannot be thwarted when A, somebody embracing themselves as part of the movement wants to go off kilter, or when the press wants to define it as something else. I think those are some things that some of the lessons that they could draw on. Mm-hmm. that they could draw on. And those, and that sort of discipline comes out of leadership that was rooted in the historical Black church.
Yeah, and first thing that struck me when you're talking about common purpose, and that's one of the things that makes this resistance a little different, is the current administration or president has been horrible to so many different groups of people for so many different reasons that you really do have a lot of people resisting, but for a lot of different reasons. Where other than their repulsion at things that Trump has done, I don't know if there's that common purpose. The other thing you talk about, and this is one of the things that I worry about in terms of cultural appropriation, you talk about the press dubbing Dr. King as the leader of this, sort of doing the same thing with Reverend, or now Bishop Barber.
I was going to say that would be
right. You know, and it's just interesting, you know, how many white Christians are being drawn. They're like, oh yes, here's another great charismatic Black preacher, and they're going to take us to the promised land. Claiming him as their spiritual leader when, you know, had any of them ever stepped into a Black church before?
Yeah, I was going to say,
how many of them would be comfortable, you know, at their own home church and they find out that their new pastor is African American?
Right.
Well, I'd back you up, Charles, because I mean, like, even King knew the inefficiency and lack of efficacy of liberal white Christianity. And so I think that's still very alive and well in that it's vogue. It's it's almost fashionable to be a supporter of William Barber rather than someone that is out there actually doing, and that their activism extends further than their social media accounts.
If I can jump in right there.
Yeah, please.
That's a great point, because two things on that. You know, I Have a Dream was not the name of Martin Luther King's keynote address at the March on Washington.
Yeah, well, that was not part of his written speech either. He ad-libbed that at the end.
Right, because he did that once before at Cobo Hall in Detroit in June of that year. And it's Mahalia Jackson that said to him, Martin, tell about your dream. So, and then Scott, I believe it was Scottie Reston of the New York Times, kept repeating it in his article the next day. But I Have a Dream was not the name of it, but that's how it gets appropriated. Also, something interesting. I don't want to bash Reverend Barber. I think he does some really great work. But it struck me when you talk about the, you know, appropriation and lessons learned. You can't go to the Democratic. If it's about a movement about changing the culture of America, you can't speak to the Democratic Convention. I know it's a lot of people. It's high profile. It's hard to resist, but you can't speak to the Democratic Convention because now, especially with the strident nature of our political discourse, you've just aligned yourself. Your moral authority just stops at the water's edge, in my view. Mm-hmm. I wonder how you guys felt about that.
Well, I talk about appropriation and culturally, having spent the last 13 years living in North Carolina and having heard Reverend Barber speak many, many times, and then looking at the Twitter blowing up with all these people, oh my gosh, oh, this is so wonderful and everything. And my response was, well, the nation now knows what North Carolina has known for a long time.
Right.
Because he didn't do anything special or different than, I mean, he's him, you know, and every time I see him on TV, it's like, yep, that's Reverend Barber.
It's an authenticity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I do understand the point. Absolutely. Again, aligning so closely with an institution, especially the political one like that, does carry some risk. You know, not sure how it's viewed. I will say what I like is that he still is doing his Moral Mondays in North Carolina. Even though his focus has obviously become more national, he's still very much part of the movement here. So I think he's walking that fine line. Definitely. But I do find it interesting, and this is something, because I was thinking this when I was at Wild Goose, because Wild Goose is a very open, accepting place, but, and I say this as an outside observer, being neither African-American nor Christian, but there was a whole hell of a lot of cultural appropriation going on.
Just a bit.
And the way I looked at it, when they had black speakers and black preachers and gospel choirs, and people saying, well, you know, why are they doing this? I'm like, well, it's wonderful for all these progressive white Christians to be made to feel just uncomfortable enough in their whiteness and their privilege so they can feel comfortable declaring their alliance with their brothers and sisters of color.
Or worse, it's entertainment and it's a little more than a minstrel show too for some.
Well, for some people, but I don't think it is for Wild Goose. I think it's that, you know, they don't realize the privilege that they have of being made to feel uncomfortable about their privilege.
No, I don't disagree with that. I'm just,
and
I'm
think
more,
for
I'm some, more pessimistic with white folks like myself.
Yeah. Well, I think it that for a lot of them, it's an attempt to, oh, okay, I still feel guilty about this. I'm good. So I can say some of my best friends are.
Let me withdraw it and let me pose it this way: is that the thought that when we were talking about this, that it can come off almost as dismissive? So I know a lot of white Christians would say, "Oh, the black church—they're just so much more spiritual,"
right?
And it's right. Sort of this—it's condescending,
right? And it's racist.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
and
you know,
so, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, that's it. I wish I had more thought on that, but.
Well, I think that to the appropriation point, though, in one sense, if it is a if whatever the medium is we're talking about is effective, in one sense, there's some level of appropriation that's almost unavoidable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you can't. I mean, only one person can be John Coltrane.
Right.
Right.
Only one person can be Miles Davis. Only one person can be Muddy Waters. Only, you know. So I think there's a certain appropriation, because if you are rooted on the side of the oppressed and choose to align with the oppressors, that is a choice.
Oh, absolutely.
And that takes on a very different, although welcomed, but that's a different social location than. You're born, you're the oppressed.
Right. Well, I guess my point is, and I'm going to drop another name, and that's Paulo Freire.
Oh, I thought
you were. Okay. We're in his Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and he talks about the role of, you know, the oppressor who does recognize this and wants to end it, that there's a difference between being humanitarian and humanistic. Between it being, you know, your assistance, your loyalty, your alliance, is it there to make you feel better? And it's still from a point of, well, I will help you up because, you know, you're so downtrodden and oppressed. Or is it really truly creating situations where you can fulfill your humanness? Yeah. And that's where I think a lot of people, again, with those good intentions, you know, miss the mark. Let me put it this way for you. I ask you this, and you know how I love throwing bombs. So we go to Beer and Hymns every month, and it just twice as has happened, sitting in a pub full of white people singing Go Down Moses and singing the verse about hopefully one day overcoming slavery. I just, you know, the irony for me, I'm like, and they don't even see it. So let me ask you this question. We're talking about music and we're talking about the spirituality of the black church being much more spiritual than white church. So what would be your attitude? And I know this is good, Tom, putting you in a tough spot here. I know I'm not asking you to speak for all African Americans. I mean, you personally, Byron.
Right.
You're watching. You're at one of these marches, and there's this throng of white people marching toward the White House, singing "We Shall Overcome."
Are they in key?
Yes.
They're
white people, so they're clapping on the one and the three.
Oh, see, okay, that's creepy. Here's my answer. I love Joe Cocker.
Mm-hmm.
Can't stand Michael Bolton.
I won't argue with that. That's
right. Yeah.
But that was an authenticity to Joe, and it comes from, you know, Michael Bolton. Oh my God. Oh, give me a break. And that's my that would be my reaction. Now,
you're talking about that. It's the degree of the authenticity of the commitment to what that song represents.
Right. Right.
And bringing it to that moment.
Right. But everybody has to stay in their voice. When New York City was sort of in its heyday, went back when the New York Times used to post, you know, some of the selected sermons from the past Sunday in the Monday paper. One of the people, William Sloan Coffin, and, you know, I pastor Riverside Church, love Sloan Coffin, but Sloan Coffin wasn't trying to preach like a black man, but he's raising these issues, making the well-heeled Riverside Church very uncomfortable and very authentic and raising issues. I think everybody has to stay in their lane. Because if you're doing it and clapping the way you said and singing the way, then you're saying, we're doing this, ergo, we have passion. No, you don't. You just look like an idiot.
Yeah, and that's where we're trying to get is how do we get that authenticity into the resistance movement. It is led by a lot of religious folks and clergy, including rabbis. I have to put out that the Trua project has been doing some wonderful stuff also, but it just seems that, you know, white Christians haven't had a march very often.
No, it's an option. It's optional.
Exactly.
Okay, no, so that's where I thought you were going to go with Bonhoeffer earlier. Because you talk about somebody that stood up as a white person and very easily any day of his life, unlike King, could just say, I'm just going to be German today.
Right.
Right.
But he was also inspired and moved from an authentic experience while he was at Union with the African-American church.
With the Abyssinian Baptist Church.
I thought Charles was going to go with that, and he threw another curve and went with something pedagogical, which is not really surprising nor a curve, but
yeah.
I thought I knew him better.
Yeah, but see, that's what keeps the mystery in the relationship.
Well, that and the alcohol.
Yeah, but Bonhoeffer's a great point, because Bonhoeffer is deeply influenced by the historical black church, and yet, you know, I mean, he's still not trying to be something other than what he is.
No, he doesn't reappropriate it in any of his works. He's him.
Right.
And so I wonder if that may be an effective, I don't know, image for white Christianity.
Another image in that is, I'm not saying it has to go to this point, but, you know, Jim Reed during the Civil Rights Movement didn't say, what's going on in Selma's bad. He went to Selma. It cost him his life, but he went to Selma. We all of us with privilege of some degree, it's not enough to, you know, appropriate it from afar. If you're going to do it, you got to do it. You know, and there's a number of white brothers and sisters that lost their lives on the front lines during that movement. None of them, I would say, were appropriating, you know, what they saw. They were in it. But I think one of the takeaway words from this conversation is authenticity is one that I'm thinking about.
Yeah, I wrote that down as soon as you put that, because I think that's a good point. Because I'm not claiming that, you know, the appropriation is intentional or that it's inevitable. It's just, it's always lurking anytime there's a borrowing from one culture to another culture.
Can appropriation become appreciation?
Well, that's the thing. It's that a lot of times appreciation becomes appropriation.
Yeah, I think it works. Definitely could work the other way.
I don't know if it can work from appropriation reversing itself to just appreciation.
Well, Charles, from now on, now going forward, now you can say to yourself, okay, am I looking at Joe Cocker or am I looking at Michael Bolton? Yeah.
I like that one. I like that one. That analogy works really, really well. And keep the clapping on the 2 and the 4, folks.
Yeah.
Or look like you're having a stroke on stage. So
yeah. Yeah. There's that too. Well, I think this is a topic that we're obviously going to be coming back to. And we're also going to be having Byron on for lots of other interesting conversations because we just always have fun talking with him.
No, this is no different. Only difference in this conversation is that I can't smoke in my building, so I don't have a cigar.
Yeah.
But I'm going to change that as soon as we're done.
Yeah. And we're going to, we got to meet at Top Leaf and record this, and we're all in the same room.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
And then we can really, really smoke up the joint. Yeah. And that'll be really good.
If it totally fails, there's still cigars.
Exactly.
Yeah, we were talking last week about the convert that you made a couple weeks ago there, the gentleman from Michigan,
right,
trying to convince him of the how shall we say it, risk of
blasphemy. Efficacy of cigar lounge?
There we go. The gospel of cigar lounges, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, so not to be culturally appropriate, but preach.
And see that's okay. There's a lot of places people go, and I just want to cringe for them. So
yeah,
preach doesn't make me cringe. There's some other things, some other places people go, and I just like stop, just stop.
Yeah, and that was, like I said, the genesis of this. That I'm not saying bad things about Wild Goose or the people who organize it, because 99% of the time it was authentic, it was people celebrating the message and appreciating the way it was delivered. But
well, that curiosity is healthy.
Yeah,
that may be the element that brings somebody. I'm having a change of heart now that I think about it. Yeah, but the fact you're there and you're being I'm coming around heart after head.
Yeah, it's just that. Maybe it's just me with the critical eye and looking at culture and things a little bit differently, because I have that different perspective as the double outsider,
right,
on this, looking and saying, for some people there is that danger of them getting so caught up into it that the next thing they know they are crossing that appropriation line.
Well, allow me to tackle one of the few public statements that I absolutely disagree with Martin Luther King on. Mm-hmm. Public statements, I'm sure there's a lot of them. And Martin Luther King was famous for saying 11 o'clock is the most segregated hour, 11 o'clock on Sunday, most segregated hour in America.
Right.
Well, if you think about that, that actually makes sense, because how we worship has a lot to do with our social location and our culture.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The worship experience is a cultural one. So
absolutely.
So if we have, let's say we have a church that's 50% white, 50% black, just for, make it easy.
Mm-hmm.
Not to exclude my Asian and Latino brothers and sisters, but just to make this conversation. Then the question is, well, what type of worship service is it going to be?
Well,
right?
There's
we're going to have to control for poverty, education,
exactly,
social location.
Exactly.
So underscoring the cultural dimension to how worship becomes an expression of the people, liturgy, the work of the people.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there is actually a great example of that in Faulkner's Sound and the Fury. There's a wonderful scene where some of the house servants of the white family bring some of the kids to the black church, and some of the white members of the town come because his famous preachers come in from the north. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting because when he starts speaking, well, first of all, the book, Faulkner never really makes it directly clear whether or not this is, person is white or black. We just know they're preaching in a black church and they're from the north. He starts out with a very white cadence and a very typical Protestant, white Protestant format and language, and everyone is just sitting listening. And then slowly he starts moving toward more of the, not stereotypical, but the typical, what people think of when they think of a black preacher, you mm-hmm. know, a king, a barber, that cadence.
Call and response.
The call and response, but also the repetition of the call.
Oh.
The rhythm of it changes. It becomes syncopated.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, the rhythm goes from the emphasis on the one and the three to the two and the four. And as he transitions, without even realizing it, that church becomes louder and louder and louder to the point where everyone is standing and, you know, screaming amen. Mm-hmm. And it's all from that transition of style
and
of prayer and preaching. And it's startling when you read it to see it. And Faulkner does a great job in describing that. And even the white participants find themselves caught up in the charisma of this preacher.
Well, two thoughts on that. One, when that happens in the black church, that is probably the last holdover from African slaves that have carried all the way into the present century. Because when they started having secret church and having church, they were still using Christianity through this African religious tradition lens. And part of that is call and response. The other part, which Charles, I know you'll understand why I'm referencing this, what you just described was Magda Goebbels' first time at a Nazi rally when she heard Hitler speak. This is saying she had to see the same thing.
Yeah, you got to write a book about that.
I think that's a good idea. Good idea. I think I might.
For those of you listening, we're representing that's a shameless plug for Byron's latest book, which hopefully will be published soon. The last moments of Magda Goebbels in the bunker playing solitaire. It's called Solitaire. I had the privilege of seeing an advanced copy, and I can't wait for it to come out and recommend it to people. I thought it was excellent.
I really
loved it. A lot of research went into it, I know, because you shared with me that most of her inner dialogue that you took from her own writing.
Yeah.
And or public statements.
Yeah.
Yeah, and letters and things like that. So.
But I want to go back. Thank you for the shameless plug. Thank you very much. but that point though, you know, that just that cultural appropriation is something that comes, in this case, what Faulkner describes is something that is probably the last vestige of the African slave that has maintained itself in the 21st century.
Well, to use a term that both of you have appropriated from my culture, amen.
Charles, we've gone nearly an hour and I haven't said the word fuck, so I just thought I'd just say that.
Oh.
Okay. All right.
This may be our least F-bomb show.
F-bomb show. Now that we plugged it at the beginning, we didn't get any in there.
That's right.
You know, I have only one word to say to that. Manischewitz.
Manischewitz.
All right.
I see. I hear Manischewitz. I think it's Sammy Davis Jr. You know,
I think of type 2 diabetes, but.
He used to be a pitch man for Manischewitz 1.
That's right. All right. So let's end with words of wisdom. Even though we've had some great words of wisdom. So Byron, again, thank you very much. And you
my pleasure, guys.
Always
my pleasure.
We love sitting and talking with you.
We'll continue this conversation at the lounge this week, right?
Absolutely.
The wife's out. The wife and kid are out of town, so I mean, you know, it could happen.
Yeah. So, as our frequent listeners know, by the way, I forgot to mention this earlier, Chris. You know how we had all those hits from Sri Lanka a couple of months ago?
Right.
Well, now we are trending in Hong Kong.
Wow.
It's about time.
Yeah. Really, really interesting. So for our longtime listeners or our new listeners in Hong Kong, you know that when I choose our words of wisdom to end, I do so for no apparent reason, with no agenda whatsoever. So I happen to have just selected this quote from an article by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and no, the quote is not, you tell your old man to drag Lanier's sorry ass up and down the floor for 48 minutes. but in an article that he wrote recently, he said, appreciating an individual item from a culture doesn't translate into accepting the whole people. While high-priced cornrows on a white celebrity on the red carpet at the Oscars is chic, those same cornrows on the little black girl in Watts, Los Angeles, are a symbol of her ghetto lifestyle. A white person looking black gets a fashion spread in a glossy magazine. A black person wearing the same thing gets pulled over by the police. One can understand the frustration.
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode, where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah.
Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/Ethan Sapphire. Shoulda woulda coulda, but I didn't, that's for real. You can't get back the hand if you didn't like